You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Universal Glamour. With an exacting eye and a circle of next-gen muses, makeup artist Sam Visser is filtering fashion, nostalgia, and aughts excess into a fresh slant by Laura Regensdorf. Opening photo by Andy Jackson. Sam Visser wears a black Dior Men sweater. And Bryce Anderson, who is being made up, wears a white shirt by Dior, styled by Nicole Chapoteau. The actor Ari Neff flashed across the Instagram feed on a weekend night in June at the close of the 2021 Tribeca Film Festival. In the photo, her lipstick gleams like a newly minted penny. Eyeshadow in a shade of papaya turns up in deft, unexpected touches, tracing the inner rim of the socket and dotting the lower lash beneath the iris. There's a feeling of archetypal elegance, but in a way that elides rule. Arresting is the word. Pulling the brakes on the habitual scroll. You can tap for the credits, but the authorship is already clear to those who've seen Kaia Gerber, Bella Hadid, and Euphoria's Barbie Ferreira undergo similar transformations. This new guard makeup is the work of Sam Visser, the California native named Dior's U.S. makeup artist ambassador earlier this year, is a precocious force. In some ways, he's in step with his peers. I feel tuned into the fact that social media is a very present thing, that it's a tool that we can use to our advantage, says Visser. I wear JNCO jeans, so I am Gen Z, he smiles. But even that nod to the wide-leg 90s favorite denim brand, enjoying a second life thanks to a boost from 20-somethings, mirrors Visser's affection for the outsize aesthetics of the past. The word that comes up repeatedly as we speak is glamour, as in glamour, 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 he stresses. I come from a generation where the attitude is so whatever, so over it, very careless. But I want to care too much. I love everything considered. Born in November 1999, as the world braced for a would-be Y2K meltdown, Visser is an apt intermediary between analog exuberance and the digital age. In grade school, Visser absorbed the lo-fi makeup tutorials of early YouTube. On weekends, he escaped to the Mac counter, designing looks on paper face charts. At 12, during a visit to LA's Makeup Forever store, he excitedly spotted the makeup artist David Hernandez, who invited Visser to shadow a shoot with David LaChapelle. That was kind of my first taste of beauty, Visser says. Before, it was all just on the screen of the internet, and never really in real life. But even a kid rooted in the online world found some of his most lasting influence in books. Make Up Your Mind, 2002, by Francois Nares, and Kevin Aucoin's iconic Making Faces, 1997, dubbed the first celebrity makeup artist for his camaraderie with the supers, immortalized in behind-the-scenes Polaroids and candid videos. Aucoin had a way of quilting together references and techniques, from silent film brows to drag-influenced sculpting. By the time Visser was 16, he had taken Aucoin's lessons in hand with clients like Tish Cyrus. That year, Kris Jenner hired Visser to do her daily makeup. He finished high school by independent study. The Kardashians steeped him in another sort of dialed-up aesthetic. The guest some conspire of the always-on reality TV persona. They are the modern version of what the Hollywood stars were, Visser says, because they get ready every single day for hours. Time has a way of folding in on itself with unlikely rhymes across decades. As Visser has shifted his track to editorial makeup, art projects, and experimental looks that he often shoots himself, the Aucoin allusions have followed. It helps that Visser's circle includes a new cast of supers, Cindy Crawford's daughter included. What feels fresh with Visser's crowd is the interplay of artist and muse, with collaborators appearing on both sides of the lens. Photographer Nadia Lee Cohen wearing a molten gold lip in a portrait series from lockdown. Or Bryce Anderson in shades of metallic seafoam and peach. Anderson, a 20-year-old photographer and model, met Visser on set a couple of years ago. Now dating, the two share a worldview along with a crazy archive at our house of special things that we've purchased, says Anderson. He cites a Francesco Scavullo book that inspired an upcoming zine of portraits for Behind the Blinds, with Visser lending makeup in the spirit of 70s legend Wabe Andy. Neither sees their work as nostalgic. Instead, they want to create worlds that transcend time and TikTok attention spans and even fashionable notions of gender fluidity. For Sam, he always says, "Makeup is just makeup," Anderson tells me. "It's not like, ooh, you're making me a woman. It's, you're just making me beautiful." And that's always been our philosophy. In the photos, Made to Last, in Visser's world, vintage photography and beauty books might inspire the makeup for a zine. Y2K-era aesthetics get a softer spin, and smart formulas enable full-face transformations. Designer Zizi Donahoe in a high-contrast look and portrait by Visser. Dior Forever Skin Glow Foundation. Dior Rouge Blush in 999. Paris Hilton in 2001. A photograph by Francesco Scavullo, an inspiration for Visser in Vogue, 1975. Making Faces, the 1997 book by makeup icon Kevin Aucoin. Dior Rouge Dior Metallic Lipstick in 756 Panache. The current thirst for circa 2000 style feeds into that pool of references. Visser looks back on the time of his birth as having a reflection of the 60s. But instead of going to the moon, we were going into the internet, he says. All the makeup ads became very metallic, and everything was shiny and sparkly. In this look on Anderson, there's a hint of cyberpop, a Paris Hilton frosted lip, pastel shadow on Britney Spears. But it's more a present tense proposition, out of the internet and into a stylized dream reality. Visser sees his work as almost punk in a way, a rogue departure from the barefaced beauty aesthetic that we've lately come to expect. In another 20 years, that's what he hopes people look back on, that glamour is an act of rebellion. Thank you. Are you on the list? New York's turn-of-the-century clubby restaurants changed social dining forever. The boom is back, and in hot new locales, by Gabe Ulla. Opening photos. The mezzanine view of Miami's Komodo 2021's answer to late 90s excess. Revelers at Moomba in 1999, shot by Larry Fink. Jason Priestley and an unidentified dinner date wait for a taxi post Nobu in 1999. At first, Ruth Reichel doesn't remember Moomba, but I looked up my review and it all came back to me, the iconic writer says, of the Greenwich Village restaurant that represented the pinnacle of New York City nightlife at the close of the last millennium. Lawrence Fishburne and Oliver Stone were investors. The Hilton sisters were always there. In 1998, Leonardo DiCaprio visited four times in a single week. What Reichel remembers is that it was dark, crowded, loud, and uncomfortable. Splashy restaurants open. Most of them close. People move on. Yet Moomba provides a window into a weird and weirdly influential era in New York dining that tends to get overshadowed by the great restaurant boom of the early 2000s. With Giuliani wielding an obscure cabaret law in his quest to stamp out fun anywhere it could be found, establishments like Moomba offered a less rambunctious but no less exclusive night on the town. Framed in today's terms, the ideal expression of this style would land comfortably between plexiglass dividers and stumbling home at 6 a.m. A number of the owners of these late 90s venues, blurring the line between club and restaurant, came from the world of discos and bars. Moomba co-owner Jeff Gossett had previously manned the door at Bowery Bar and Spy. So many people in their 20s got sick of the clubs and began going to restaurants, Gossett told The Independent at the time. They didn't want to be with 16-year-olds taking ecstasy and being frisked at the door. I stopped seeing them. Now I'm seeing them again. In 1995, Reichel awarded 3 stars in her New York Times column to a Japanese Peruvian restaurant in Tribeca with no tablecloths, plenty of house music, and partners who included former Studio 54 gatekeeper Richard Notar, the original Nobu on the corner of Hudson and Franklin. You didn't want to be put out to pasture, and you didn't want champagne spilled on you either, says Notar of the dining style Nobu helped pioneer. The restaurant, which opened in 1984, was still the place to be toward the end of the decade, as buzzy spots like Asia de Cuba, Moomba, and Baltazar debuted. Each, at some point, had a doorman. Some created private reservations hotlines for A-listers. Moomba chef and founding partner Frank Falcinelli recalls that staff would communicate via headset to keep tabs on the latest notable arrival. It was like we were in the Secret Service. Madonna's here in 5. Jacqueline Schnabel is back for dinner. Prince showed up and wants to spin records. In the illustration, Cheers, Orlando Franklin, head bartender at Brooklyn Lounge with Dancing Night Moves, presents a 20s take on that old 90s standby, the Cosmo. 0.25 ounces elsewhere strawberry rhubarb aperitivo. 0.25 ounces Clear Creek cranberry liqueur. 0.75 ounces lime juice. 0.5 ounces Cointreau. 1.5 ounces The Street Puma's Vodka, 0.25 ounces cane syrup. Add all ingredients to a mixing tin, shake, and strain into a well-chilled coupe or Nicanora glass. Enjoy! You can play up the exclusivity and that can keep you busy for a little while, says Notar, but for it to last, you have to have something to back it up. From Nobu Matsuisa's widely cribbed catalog to the atmospheric language created by architect David Rockwell, Nobu would inform electric restaurants for decades. The DNA runs through current mainstays like Marimoto and Tao, and the very Mumba-like work of Amy Sacco, but also in any takeout menu with a dish combining yellowtail and jalapeno. For a contemporary display of fin de siècle spirit, it's hard to surpass Miami. Komodo, a big box in Brickell, is a collaboration between club owner David Grutman and Asia de Cuba founder Jeffrey Chodorow. At the Korean steakhouse Kot in the Design District, the neon-lit entryway is intended to look like the coat check at a nightclub. Every day, promptly at 5 p.m., which is when Kot opens, the subwoofer begins asserting itself. The venue is one of many brash restaurants that cropped up in South Florida during the pandemic, including Outpost of New York's Carbon and Austin's Uchi, and Grutman's latest Strawberry Moon with partner Pharrell Williams. In creating Kot, founder Simon Kim says he wanted to marry his fine dining training with the revelry he developed a taste for as a UNLV undergrad. You can get lit here, but it's the highest level of hospitality. Mumba, New York City, shut down months before 9/11. Its L.A. follow-up lasted only a little longer. From one day to the next, the whole thing looked gauche, Falcinelli recalls. Though the action in Miami seems to suggest less soul-searching today than took place two decades ago, Notar believes that attitudes have changed. Now, if you call and they tell you they are fully booked, he says, you might just look at your spouse and say, okay, maybe we'll try again another day. freed up by Gabe Allah. And in the photo, Julia Momose serves luscious drinks, no booze needed. Chicago-based bartender Julia Momose does not miss the days when customers would ask for non-alcoholic options, almost like they were apologizing to us. Things have changed for the better, she says, as she and her peers explore the world of spirit-free drinks, her preferred term, with verve. Now, Momose believes, the notion of going out and not drinking has never been more acceptable. At Kumiko in the West Loop, Momose's work in the category ranks among the country's best. Instead of straining to imitate a Negroni or gin and tonic, she focuses on the sensation the drink should deliver. She proudly remembers a pairing for a rye pasta with butter and truffles. She toasted and steeped some barley and then infused the tea with baking spices, buds the flavor of honeysuckle, and a banana peel syrup. Momose served the drink in a whiskey glass. You are only limited when you work in the shadow of the alcoholic version. And with the help of Momose's forthcoming book, The Way of the Cocktail, or author Julia Bainbridge's recent hit, Good Drinks, you can most definitely try it at home. Navel gazing. When Bearing Your Soul Meant Bearing Your Midriff by Sonia Soraya. Opening photo, performing at the MTV VMAs in 2001, Britney Spears embraced her exotic influences. And here she's dressed as a belly dancer. I suppose Britney Spears' belly button is where it begins. Life, after all, begins at the navel, that vestige of our time in the womb, the scar of our severed connection to our mothers, the center of our earthly forms, an opening on the underside of our fleshy, vulnerable bellies. Navels collect debris, snacking, apparently, as they peek out from under our clothes. When you look down, they stare right back up, mouths open in perpetual surprise. Oh, brave new world! It's a question of some theological controversy as to whether Adam and Eve had navels. There are those who believe their prehistoric torsos were smoothly intact. That sounds pleasing, except when one is confronted with one of those rare folks without a belly button. Something feels off, and one longs for the wabi-sabi pucker denoting human symmetry. Karolina Kharkova, the supermodel, barely has a visible navel because of a surgery when she was an infant, and that rarely goes without comment in her line of work. In the past, a stranger's navel has been photoshopped onto her stomach. I watched a reality program where a woman lamented how a tummy tuck had robbed her of her belly button. She was in a surgeon's office asking to get it back. Sure, it was a scar, but it was her scar. I had a navel before 1998, but I was never so aware of it until I saw Britney Spears's. Mine was a little divot in my round stomach, as if my stomach was the event horizon of my navel's black hole. Britney's was a playful little indent in her impossibly narrow stomach, a flat slab of tanned muscle gyrating below a sports bra and above baggy pants in the music video for Baby One More Time. It peeked out almost by accident, as if the teen Britney had overnight outgrown her little girl clothes. That 1998 music video is a semiotic minefield, with Spears in pigtails and lipstick, pink poofs in her hair, dancing through the halls of a high school in a deconstructed school uniform. The belly button spoke of childlike nudity, a kid running through a sprinkler, exposed but carefree. But it also winked knowingly, undulating like a belly dancer's, suggesting other crevices, inviting a different sort of play. I had pigtails, lipstick, and even a school uniform. But even though I was sucking in my stomach to imitate her, it was immediately obvious to me that I would never, could never, be Britney Spears. She was brazenly toying with sexual maturity and the scraps of girlhood, sending the country into a frenzy for pinpointing exactly what might turn it on. I'm Not a Girl, Yet Not Yet a Woman didn't come out until 2001, but that song's paradoxical title is the essence of Britney's sexual appeal. The uncomfortable line she danced on for years. That gray area lasted longer than any of us could have imagined. This summer, Britney testified that for 13 years, she has been under an abusive legal conservatorship that curtails her independence, telling a judge, "I just want my life back." But when I became a teenager, it was undeniably her moment, and her power held us all in thrall. And when I say power, what I mean is her belly button. Early on, Britney never did a video without flaunting her navel, even in Lucky, which is partially set in a nostalgic movie star era. She'd pull up the bottom of her top and pull down the waistband of her pants if she had to. Her belly button invited a carefully calibrated intimacy to an orifice sandblasted clean of human grime, but it was intimacy nonetheless. It also suggested a whiff of the sumptuous foreign while remaining grounded in Brittany's southern-accented, mall-friendly, small-town appeal. At the MTV VMAs in 2001, she leaned into her so-called exotic influences, moving onto the stage oiled and tousled with an albino Burmese python draped over her shoulders. Her backup dancers, many dark-skinned, lurked around her, daubed with something like war paint. Rhinestones and scarves bedecked her hips, and in the center was her navel, fish-hooked with a prominent piercing, glinting under the stage lights. In 1993, after Alicia Silverstone pierced her navel as an act of defiance in the video for Aerosmith's Cryin', and Naomi Campbell and Christy Turlington flaunted navel rings on runways, the belly became a fixture of the One World New Age 90s. Fiona Apple, TLC, and Sinead O'Connor all bared theirs. But once Brittany claimed the navel, its tenor changed. It wasn't vulnerable in its nakedness. It was powerful, especially when packaged with low-rise jeans, a whale tail, where the of-the-moment thong crept up past the waistline, and a tramp stamp lower back tattoo to seal the deal. The fact that teenage girls were encouraged to empower themselves by embracing their sexuality reveals how sneakily the interest of the presumed male observer trumped the girls in question. Ironically, Brittany's navel had power, but she didn't. Witness how 1999's American Beauty slavers over Mina Suvari's belly. The image on the poster isn't in the film, but the demure sensuality beckoning the male viewer is potent nonetheless. In the movie, she's being ogled by Kevin Spacey, and the target of this teen sexuality, as with Brittany's videos, is the male audience member, encouraged to look but unable to touch. Keira Knightley and her navel broke out in 2002's Bend It Like Beckham. In the following year's Love Actually, writer-director Richard Curtis was reportedly so taken by her bare midriff that he asked the costumers to design her wedding dress to showcase it. A bridal crop top was apparently considered, but eventually they went the translucent route. The enticing navel invariably belonged to the same kind of belly, a flat, white, female one, often underage, and achieving the Brittany bod took some doing. Already a svelte dancer, Spears herself had to shift her diet to steamed vegetables. Famously, hauntingly, she did something like 1,000 crunches a day. As the navel emerged, so too did the cottage industry of getting midriff-bearing abs and achieving the paradox of toned but not too toned. Despite its suggestion of the counterculture, with that soupçon of piercing pagoda rebellion, the turn of the millennium navel wound up reinforcing the status quo. There's often a fluid squishiness to a belly dancer's stomach, or a well-worn pooch over the drawstring securing an Indian lehenga. In Japan, festivals find men and women turning their torsos into big faces, drawing exaggerated mouths atop the navels. The OO's era, bared navel, may have suggested only freedom, but it ultimately became another kind of stricture. There's a pivotal belly button scene in 1999's The Matrix. The bad guys, the agents of the machines, have cornered Keanu Reeves in an interrogation room. When he gives them lip, his lips fuse together. As he tries to scream, The agents tear open his shirt and hold him down to a skittering bug-like machine, so a skittering bug-like machine can burrow into his navel. It's an unsettling torture, but given the tensions of the movie, a device nestling into the umbilicus foreshadows how machines have taken over human reproduction. It ends up being a subtle commentary, the horror of the invasion of the navel, a digital metaphor for navel gazing, and even a gender reversal where it's a man's navel that is revealed. 20 years later, the navel gazing of the OOs feels shallow, an obsession with the pert belly button of youth, when what's truly enticing about the navel is its universality and flexibility, how it ebbs and flows with our bodies. But even today, we're haunted by the Britney bod, of course. Kim Kardashian, who has a pierced navel, went public about the expensive ultrasound and laser treatments intended to tighten her belly button area after pregnancy. Beyonce did not share much about her reportedly grueling workout regimen when she showed off her post-baby body on the cover of Shape in 2013, but she made sure to showcase her flat stomach, adorned with a jeweled piercing. Even Britney is haunted by her own taut belly. In the tumultuous years following her superstardom, whenever her stomach displayed a hint of softness, the tabloids couldn't get enough of it. Now, she alleges, the conservatorship won't allow her to have another baby. Britney is literally struggling to reclaim her belly. In the OOs, we claim to be revealing our navels, but I think we were too afraid to really see them for the strange shapeshifters they are. But they and we are still here. My own navel stretched so much during my pregnancy that it awkwardly became an outie. Now, even though it's back to its original form, I can see all the way into it, where the edges of that wound seal together. It's only a plug of scar tissue from my mom, revealed to me as I became a mom, but it took a few decades to get to the bottom of it. Gawker Stalker. The kids, once shooting spitballs at the media establishment, have taken it over, by Michael Calderon. And the opening illustration shows the world with various things pinpointed on it, sites such as San Francisco, Austin, Los Angeles. Launched in 2002, Manhattan Obsessed Gawker became the flagship of a sprawling digital media empire, promising blunt takes and inside dope on everything from tech to politics, sports to video games. Though killed off by a Peter Thiel-funded lawsuit over publication of a sex tape starring Hulk Hogan, Gawker's influence and that of hell-raising siblings like Deadspin, Jezebel, and Gizmodo is evident by turning on HBO or opening the New York Times. As a new owner tries reviving the Gawker brand, here's how its tentacles have spread throughout media and entertainment. Nick Denton, since selling his gossip empire to Univision, the enigmatic Gawker media chief, whose Soho loft was once a mildly debauched media party zone, has cultivated an air of mystery around a possible next act, hinting on Twitter about a future story-making app. Corey Sika, his chatty and biting style set the tone for early Gawker and much of the internet. After co-founding The All, where he cultivated a new generation of wryly observant internet writers, he went legit, reshaping the New York Times style section before returning to writing at New York Magazine. Evan Narcisse, after covering the dearth of cool black characters in video games and the necessity of Black Panther for Kotaku, Narcisse went on to write The Rise of the Black Panther series and Spider-Man. Miles Morales game. Jessica Cohen, choosing an education at Gawker over Columbia Journalism School, the early era editor-in-chief and later top Jezebel editor, went on to lead newsrooms at Vocative and Mashable before joining newsletter juggernaut Morning Brew as chief content officer. Kara Brown, having explored race, culture, and celebrity as a senior writer at Jezebel, Brown is now making her mark on the TV world, writing for Grownish, In the Dark, and forthcoming Marvel series She-Hulk. Gia Tolentino, starting at All, sister site The Hairpin, and later becoming a Jezebel deputy editor, Tolentino gained a following for sharp-witted cultural commentary. Now a New Yorker staff writer, her essay collection, Trick Mirror, racked up critics' raves. Katie Weaver, from joining a Paula Deen cruise to gorging at TGI Fridays, the Gawker writer took stunt journalism to sublime new heights. Her talents earned her a gig writing cover stories for GQ before the NYT Styles Desk and magazine scooped her up. Hamilton Nolan, one of Gawker's longest-serving writers, Nolan chronicled the media business, and by organizing the site's staff, helped set off a wave of unionization across the industry. Nolan now covers labor for In These Times. John Cook. Getting tailed by Roger Ailes didn't stop Cook from probing Fox News and other power centers for Gawker, a path he's continued as investigations editor at Insider, working alongside deputy and ex-Gawker Gizmodo reporter J.K. Trotter. A.J. Dolario, after igniting a Brett Favre sexting scandal at Deadspin, he posted the Hulk Hogan sex tape that sunk Gawker in court. The notoriously hard-partying Dolario has since shifted gears, founding recovery newsletter The Small Bow. Cord Jefferson, taking home an Emmy last year with Damon Lindelof, the former West Coast editor has written for Watchmen, Succession, and with former editor-in-chief Max Reed, conceived a Gawker-inspired scripted show called Scrapner. Next part of the illustration shows New York City and some other sites nearby. Leah Finnegan. Even Denton bristled at the former feature editor's scathing post. Now Finnegan is leading a relaunched Gawker under new owner and past Jezebel and Valleywag target Brian Goldberg, whom she's already mocked to the press. Adrian Chin. At Gawker, he took on 4chan trolls and chronicled goats. Maybe don't look that up. Before exploring internet culture for The New Yorker as a staff writer, he since left the magazine and is now working on a book. Pooja Patel, tackling everything at Deadspin from Taylor Swift feminism to the etiquette of people sleeping with their co-workers, the former senior editor became Spin's top editor before joining the Condé Nast stable as editor-in-chief of indie mainstay Pitchfork. Tom Skolka, a renowned Gawker and Deadspin editor, Skolka also wrote it on allegations against Bill Cosby when nearly no one else was, and argued for snark over smarm. He launched Hmm Daily before becoming Slate's politics editor. Emma Carmichael, after playing key roles throughout Gawker Media, Jezebel editor-in-chief, managing editor of Gawker and Deadspin, Carmichael, has written for Wyatt Chenack's Problem Areas, and along with alum Leah Beckman, was also working on Scraper before Apple pulled the plug. Richard Lawson, beginning his Gawker writing career as anonymous commenter LOL Kate, Lawson jumped from ad sales to editorial and became one of the site's most popular contributors, chronicling contemporary celebrity culture with absurdist flair. And now he's with us as Vanity Fair's chief critic. Owen Thomas, dropping gossip bombs on tech titans, such as outing Peter Thiel, Thomas put the industry on edge as Valleywag managing editor and has kept it in his sights while serving as an editor at Business Insider, the San Francisco Chronicle, and now Protocol. Anna Holmes, as the founding editor-in-chief of Jezebel, she reinvented our idea of blogging. After 3 years at the helm, she held high-ranking editorial roles of Fusion and Topic.com and now helps steer the Obama's empire as EVP, Creative Director at Higher Ground Productions. Elizabeth Spears, Gawker's founding editor-in-chief, went on to helm the New York Observer under then-owner Jared Kushner, whose incompetence as a media owner and White House advisor, she's quick to point out. Spears now heads progressive digital strategy company The Insurrection and teaches media and innovation at NYU. Emily Gould, from gracing the cover of the New York Times Magazine to debating Jimmy Kimmel, Gould moved beyond just internet famous. The original confessional blogger, who is also half of an aughts media world couple, she's married to N plus L founder Keith Gessen, is the author of the novels Perfect Tunes and Friendship, and wrote a column in this issue. Dodage Stewart. A distinctive Jezebel voice in the early years, Stewart led Splinter, a site carrying on the Gawker flame until shuttering itself in 2019. The native New Yorker jumped to the Times as deputy Metro editor and now deputy editor for Narrative Projects. Alex Perrine, dropping out of NYU to write for a DC-skewering Wankette and serving as Gawker's editor-in-chief nearly a decade later, the epically acidic Perrine now serves up incisive political analysis as a staff writer at the New Republic. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.